Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Tom Andrews has published two books of poems. His first book, The Brother's Country, was a winner of the 1989 National Poetry Series. It was published by Persia Books. His second, The Hemophiliac's Motorcycle, won the 1993 Iowa Poets Prize. He has also edited a collection of essays and reviews on the work of the late William Stafford, who incidentally gave two readings for the Poetry Center. And Andrews's poems have appeared in the well-known annual Best American Poetry that comes out every year. A third book, Codeline Diary, The Politics of Hemophilia in the Age of AIDS, will be published in February by Little Brown. He teaches at Purdue. Andrews' books contain poems written with unusual intensity and precision, poems that hang way out there at the edge of being. There is also elegy and there's humor, as in the opening lines of the title poem of his second book. It's humor that dances at that edge, I mentioned a second ago. In the past few years, he has occupied himself with another kind of humor, zany and high-spirited. He has written tiny, in his words, unfilmable film scripts with titles like William Makepeace Thackeray Follows His Bliss. How can you resist that? And now, Tom, would you come up and please read for us?
Elementary school kids with poetry in the school programs. And I am continually humbled and wonder what happened to us. Why can't we get back to that amazing connection with the imagination, with language, what have you? So I'm just going to read you two very brief poems from one of the workshops that I gave. The first one is written by a fourth grader named Alan. It has one of the great first lines, I think. I should say, too, that both of these, since I'm only reading two, were written in 8 minutes. I wonder about my breath. All the grasses are tangled because it's raining and catching the lights. The lights are coming through the months and catching grass. The tangle is so fast, I can't catch it. 8 minutes. And the next one was written by a fifth grader named Tamara. The bees come and buzz in the raspberries. They get the creamy insides of the raspberries. They finally get to the bottom where the green stem is, and they go down that road, moaning until it's dark. Oh, yeah, thanks. Thank you. Okay. Great. My gosh. I think I do have enough for everyone now. If you'd like to come up. That last poem was written by a fifth grader named D.H. Lawrence. And of course, I immediately published it under my own name. All right. I'm going to read a poem that came out of an assignment that I always give my introductory poetry workshops. And the assignment is to come up with a title, an outrageously specific title, like James Wright's titles, a crazy title like many of Wallace Stevens' titles, and then have that generate the poem rather than the other way around. And the title of this one is Dr. Farnsworth, a Chiropodist, Lived in Ohio, where he wrote only the first lines of poems. And it's simply 12 first lines separated by a lot of white space. One, the moon smells like a fishbone. The cow... 2. Plotinus, Porphyry, strolling the lakes. 3. 1925, mountain, table, anchors, navel. 4. The smell of God in wood. 5. And this one's in quotation points, marks. She came to him, nuzzling his chest. 6. Chaos in ochre, time in the physical, light. 7. Past the barn, past the worm-ridden apple trees. 8. Organ swell, cadence, Swedenborg with a walking stick. 9. The sun lost. 10. I have never dreamed of water. 11. Will God work only in geometry? Emerson. 12. Say of me that I am living still. This next poem is only 4 lines long. It's called Ars Poetica. The dead drag a grappling hook for the living. The hook is enormous. Suddenly, it is tiny. Suddenly, one's voice is a small body falling through silt and weeds, reaching wildly. Reading that poem, I keep thinking of this interview with James Thurber, in which the interviewer admitted to having read Thurber originally in a French translation, and after reading Thurber in English, he said he preferred the French translation. And Thurber said, "That's always been my problem. I lose something in the original." There's something profoundly true about writing in that remark. Let's see here. This is a poem to one of the poets who has meant a great deal to me, Paul Celan, the German language poet, whose poems were severely elliptical and haunted by absences. And I've tried to emulate that in the poem. The title is simply Paul Celan, and it's a group of 5 line or so short poems. Travelers above us, vulture and star, and you, your name, 2 knots in the rope of your breath. Are you asleep? There's no one's voice again. You hear a murmur in the tubes in your throat. You hear your slow drip in the urine sac. You hear your heart, which fell to pieces in the surgeon's hands. You hear it beating. You hear me carving someone else's name in your crutches. You star hard. Words sought you out and brought you back. Are you asleep? There's no one's voice again. Flower, word of the blind. Our look waters it. In the name of the blood coin, the open vein, in the name of the lonely witness, there are unheard rivers inside us. There are cathedrals we never see. You fingered your death like a breadcrumb in your pocket. You're taking it out. You're placing it on your lip. Are you asleep? There's no one's voice again. Now I'm going to read one or two of these unfilmable film scripts, which I think of as sort of goofy and full of joy. The first one is called 6 One-Line Film Scripts, and I love one-line poems, and I was trying to think, you know, how much can you pare down a film script? And so here are 6 attempts to write a film in one line. Each of them has a title. Film Noir. Everyone on Earth is asleep, except Robert Mitchum. French Flick. The camera is an emptiness that longs to be a camera. Historical epic. Thousands of extras reset their alarm clocks. This one's called Stefan Mallarmé Counts the Buttons on the Hangman's Vest, and he speaks this line. God, guilt, and death. This will not work on film. The needle, medium shot of a camel squeezing through the eye of a needle. This is the only other one I'll read. It's called The Death of Alfred Lord Tennyson. And it begins with the camera panning a gorgeous snow-filled landscape, rolling hills, large black trees, a frozen river. The snow falls and falls. The camera stops to find Tennyson in an armchair in the middle of a snowy field. And he speaks. It's snowing. The snow is like crushed aspirin, like bits of paper. No, it's like gauze bandages, clean teeth, shoelaces, headlights. No, I'm getting too old for this. It's like a huge t-shirt that's been chewed on by a dog. It's like semen, confetti, chalk, seashells, wood smoke, ash, soap, trillium, solitude, daydreaming, hell you can see for yourself. That's what I hate about film. He dies. That's it. Now I'm going to read a bit from this memoir, Codeine Diary. This has been quite an instructive experience for someone who's been writing poems, because those of you who write know that you are begging anybody to spit on your poems constantly. And so a memoir presents the absurd idea of an audience out there. And I was just visiting the office of the publisher on the same day that Paula Barbieri was there, because she had just written a memoir called The Other Woman. And I thought, great, let's see if she'll give us a blurb, you know, for my book. And the editor said, well, frankly, I'd be happy if she just read her own book. And, you know, I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, apparently Dennis Rodman, in a recent interview, had admitted that he had not read all of his book. So, and then I was thinking, well, that's all right. You know, the blurb can be, if you only read one book a year, like me, read this one, you know. Or even picking it up gave me great pleasure, or something like that. Well, this book is basically the story of 2 days which keep intersecting each other, one when I was 11 and one when I was 28. And I'm going to read a couple of the 11-year-old day, the sections that have to do with that are very brief, and they fall in between chapters. When I was 11, I was listed in the Guinness Book of World Records for clapping my hands, which is an absurd thing for anybody to do, but for a hemophiliac, it's even crazier. You know, God knows what my parents did. God bless them. And I was also very interested in mathematics at the time, so I'm thinking about all these mathematical ideas as I'm clapping my hands. I had a brother who had kidney disease, and we had a dialysis machine in our home, and that comes up in some of these sections. So in this one, I'm sitting around the house clapping with my brother as we're watching TV. My mother comes into the room. John and I, my brother and I, sat on the sofa watching The Price is Right. We had the volume turned up so we could hear Bob Barker above the sound of my clapping. My mother had been in the kitchen thinking about the spiritual delinquencies of her children. She looked at John and me staring at TV. I looked up at her. She had curly brown hair and wide glasses with brown frames. "Tell me this, Tom," she said. Her voice was grave and direct. "Are you doing this for God's glory or your own?" "God's," I said, automatically. Bob Barker smooched the wife of a man who had just won a camper and a Yamaha dirt bike. "Aha," my mother said. I lied, of course. I tried to shrug off my mother's question, but it got to me. I was deeply ashamed of the worldly ambition my record represented. When the record appeared a year later, several classmates at Oakwood Elementary School came up to me holding hardcover copies of the Guinness Book of World Records and asked if that was really me who had clapped his hands. "Oh no," I explained, "my brother's the one who broke the record, but there was this horrible mix-up and they printed my name instead. Boy, is he pissed." I clapped, glancing at the clock every few minutes. Now it was 2:22 p.m. In an hour and 11 minutes, it would be 3:33 p.m. An hour and 11 minutes later, it would be 4:44. Numbers, even their simplest interactions could ricochet in the mind. More than a world record for clapping, more than a Roberto Clemente baseball card or a Schwinn Stingray, though definitely not more than a Honda XR75, the apotheosis of all my desires, I wanted to discover a new prime number. Why? Did something in me respond to the purity and austerity of numbers, their echoing collisions and reciprocities? Maybe. But what I remember most was a sense of competition picked up from my teacher's praise. Praise can ruin you. I would find the newest prime number. Euclid had proved there was no end to them. I made lists of numbers into the millions, looking for primes. I felt guilty about such an ambitious goal, but wouldn't God want me to find a new prime number? After all, hadn't God created the prime numbers in the first place and left them to be discovered like new planets in distant galaxies? On the other hand, you never heard much about Jesus doing well in math. All right. I'm going to skip ahead now to a section where we're back at this day when I'm 28. Basically, I have a bleed, and I'm in the hospital. And one of the things I wanted to do in this book was to faithfully and unhysterically and unsentimentally record what it's like to be in a hospital, which I've never seen accurately. It's a crazy place. I mean, it's a hilarious place. All sorts of funny things, dreadful things are going on all the time. And it was the job of one nurse one night to take my pulse in my leg every 5 minutes to make sure the blood vessels hadn't collapsed. And so we pretty much talked for about 6 hours in the middle of the night, and we had this amazing conversation. And so these are just snippets from that conversation, which are separated by a lot of space. I'll simply pause in between them. Her name is Ellen. Ellen said, "My husband used to feed his dog gunpowder to make it mean to strangers. It worked." I said, "My mother told me that every time I lied, I put another thorn in Jesus' head." I said, "It's strange how little racing there was in motocross. When I was a little older than 11, I started racing motorcycles, which, you know, for a hemophiliac, it's like, well, a bad insurance risk, I think. Anyway, it's strange how little racing there was in motocross. I mean actual racing, where you get in a dogfight over a position. Usually we settled into our places early in the motos, as if they'd been determined by God. Now that I think about it, the race was probably over during practice. We went out and after a few laps decided who was faster than us and who we were faster than, And sure enough, that's how the race would turn out. You were a bunch of, what's the word, Calvinist dirt bikers, Ellen said. Now that, I said, is hitting below the belt. Ellen said, I think men just hang around me till they get the hang of life again. They lean on me till they get the swing of life back. Oh, there was a time when I thought everything was about hemophilia, I said. The secret agenda of punk, pardon me, the secret agenda of punk was hemophilia. Same with motocross, skateboarding, Christianity. Christianity, how'd you figure that one? It was all about hemophilia. The blood of the lamb, take this blood which is shed for thee, all that. I figured Jesus was a very well-adjusted chronic bleeder. I told you, Ellen said, I'm hopeless. Just the thought of a math test makes my stomach tense up. Okay, wait. Don't give up yet. We're not talking about taking a test. We're just talking about the way mathematicians see things. Here's an example, the best example I know of. There was this German mathematician named Carl Friedrich Gauss. Most mathematicians I know say he was the best who ever lived. When Gauss was a kid in school, his teacher asked the class to add up all the numbers between 1 and 100. The teacher probably thought he was giving himself a 10-minute break or something. Gauss had the answer in a few seconds. He saw that 1 plus 100 is 101, 2 plus 99 is 101, 3 plus 98 is 101, and so on. He saw that there were 50 pairs of numbers that added up to 101. The answer then had to be 50 times 101, or 5,050. See what I mean? The point is, he saw a pattern in the numbers that had to lead to the answer. He didn't have to add up all those numbers. I can see that, Ellen said. I can, but it doesn't do anything for me. It's like watching figure skating on TV. It's great that there are people who can do all those flips and spins and stuff, but I'm sure as hell not going to go out and do it myself. And I'm going to end with this section. This is a more serious or earnest discussion of mathematics and its connections with poetry. When I was in the waiting room, I had tried to dredge up a theorem to distract me from pain. I loved working on difficult mathematical theorems. I loved the way my mind felt, intensely focused, alert, transfixed, as I worked. It was very much like working on a poem, but without the sometimes maddening, sometimes delighting, always politically and emotionally charged imprecision of words. No wonder Paul Valéry longed for his poems to embody, quote, the solidity of certain pages of algebra. Working on a problem, you feel the answer moving in you, an obscure presence in your knees, in your body. It starts in the backs of the knees, then rises slowly into the spine, traversing blood and muscle tissue. The answer is patient, shy, fragile. If coaxed too soon up the spinal column into the brain, it dissolves like a sugar cube in hot tea. This all takes place, mind you, while you're beating your head against the wall. You feel the answer nestling there in the knees, in the spine. The excitement is tremendous as the solution inches upward intact into your consciousness. That's when it's easiest to lose concentration, make a mistake. You anticipate the joy of solving the problem rather than keep working on it. But when you do solve it, it's as though your body, which moments before was a hugely complicated knot, is untied quickly with a single firm tug. Then, to shift from a sexual to an electrical metaphor, your body seems to buzz a little, to tap into a low galvanic current. My work at Math Reviews, I was working at a journal as an editor called Mathematical Reviews at the time. My work at Math Reviews put me in daily contact with gifted mathematicians around the world, despite, or perhaps because of, the fact that they moved through the material world as through dense fog, unsure of their footing, unable to pause for more than a few minutes from whatever problem was currently obsessing them, the mathematicians I met and corresponded with were seeking something beyond themselves, something unprecedented. In that sense, I saw them as heroic. Now I wanted to breathe on the heroic. I recalled a theorem of Srinivasa Ramanujan's, the great Indian mathematician. It worked its magic, filling me, as it always did, with awe and with something like sublimity. This is what the theorem looks like. It was one of several that Ramanujan sent to an English mathematician named G.H. Hardy. He sent it from backwoods India and was self-taught and a genius. I kept this theorem taped to the wall in front of my desk at work, flanked by a haunting poem of Jean Valentine's called After Elegies and a black and white photo of Carrie, my former wife, smoking. The theorem fascinated and troubled me. Sometimes looking at it filled me with a strange calm. Other times it induced vertigo. Sometimes it was like music, slow, grave music that occasionally and without warning erupted into passionate, dissonant bursts, crisp glissandos and arpeggios, a Bach partita metamorphosed into a Schoenberg gigue. Sometimes the theorem, like music, entered me and spread inside me, enlarging my sense of what is possible, enlarging me. More often than not, though, it remained as mute as the wall it was taped to. All right. I'm going to end with a section from an elegy for my brother. The poem is called The Brother's Country. It's the first poem in my first book. And this is the ninth and last section. And it's set at his graveyard in West Virginia. It must be a country without pain. It must be a quiet place where the stillness under your wrist is entered like a field of thyme and peppergrass, the sun breaking out over a slight rise of hills, the familiar burdens of clouds keeping in touch. And I think of your lifted features, how I've hunted them all night through the March dark, piecing you back and back, trying to take what this landscape is giving me, watered lawns, a well, and across a two-lane highway, slow cows grazing the black earth. Brother, this is the miracle. We began alike, that man's secret told twice to that woman. Thank you very much for coming.